Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind everyone that a volunteer, Charlie, has agreed to process any suggestions you have about topics to cover, segments to prepare, documents to review that can aid and support this program. In effect, we're inviting you to be partners. Send anything that you have for us to look at to charlie.info438@gmail.com. Today's program is going to be devoted to politics, in particular, politics of the left. It's not the caricature of the left that right-wingers like to propose, in which all the distinctions among socialists, Marxists, independents, left-wing liberals are all smashed together and made into an evil awful. That's not serious. That's the kind of hatchet job that passes for politics in some areas, but we're not going to bother with it. And we're also not going to deal with the dismissal of the left that you get from leaders of the Democratic Party, particularly its centrist wing, like the Biden folks or the Clinton folks, who deal with the left as if it were an irritation. Except, of course, during campaigns when progressive ideas are all the rage until the election is over. No, I'm talking about the real left. That is something I need to define. It's millions of people in the United States, and for that matter abroad, who have come to understand that the problems we face are the problems of the whole system we live in. And that system change is the solution, one way or another, that we are in fact aiming at. That's for me the real left. It has many forms, it has many particular objects of its interest, whether it's the relations between men and women, between white and non-white, regional, ethnic, whatever else. People concerned about the planet and the destruction of nature, people who see the injustices of economic, political, and cultural inequality. They understand these are not particular problems. These are particular aspects of one big problem, and that is the economic, political, and cultural system we live with. The people who see that, who understand that systemic change is on the agenda and is what we need, those are the people I call the real left. In the United States, you'll find many of them supporting Bernie Sanders, AOC. You'll find some who are critical of Bernie Sanders and AOC, but usually the grounds for the debate and the arguments are among people who agree that we need systemic change in the United States. The other preliminary to getting into this has to do with this word, socialism. It's a difficult word here in the United States, because so much time, energy, and money has been devoted to demonizing it, to making it a bad word, to making it somehow so awful, so evil, that people don't learn about it, don't understand the differences among socialists, don't much care, and simply demonize, coming out of a religious or other traditions in which there is God and the devil, and you make your choice between them. I'm trying to talk to people who are not in that either-or frame of mind. They are open enough to understand that there might be something to be said for making a systemic criticism, that is, the problem is the system, and coming up with a systemic solution. Well, over the last three centuries, the number one tradition that has achieved that is the tradition of socialism. And by socialism, people have meant many different things, just like the word capitalism has meant different things to people. Is simply ignorance or malevolence that makes believe there are no differences. It's all one thing. Never was, and it is not now. But the socialist tradition gathered the critics of this system. They're the ones who came up with the convention of calling it the capitalist system, to give it a name, to give it a core, which had to do with the economics of that system, the organization of the production of goods and services in a very particular way, with employers, a tiny minority, and employees, a vast majority, but a production system inside every factory, office, and store, which gave a tiny minority, the owners, the operators, the board of directors, the power to control, to organize, to dictate what goes on inside the business. The small group was a dictatorship of the capitalists, the people investing to make money. And the mass of people, they were the working class or the employees, or whatever you wanted to call them, but they were at the bottom in the production system of this society. They had to do what the dictatorship of the few, the capitalists, made them do. On the job, you were like a slave. That's why they used to call workers wage slaves. Hint, hint, in case you didn't get it. And so socialism became the framework, the identity, the focus of those who made a systemic criticism. They argued that the human relationships that constitute our lives can and should be changed by having a focus on making sure that the economy was fundamentally changed. And that was quite different from the way critics of systems in the past understood their situation and develop their strategies for change. The problem is that in the 19th and 20th century, socialism, the key traditional critic of capitalism, made a strategic decision that was, on the one hand, very successful, yet on the other, a problem. First, the success. Socialists barely existed in, say, 1820, 200 years ago. Today, socialists exist on every corner of this planet. Socialist parties, socialist newspapers, socialist trade unions, socialist governments, they're everywhere. The idea spread like wildfire in the 19th and 20th century. One of the great expansions of a set of ideas that exist in the history of the human race. And their idea was very particular. The problem of the system we live in, they said, was the private, profit-driven capitalist. That's partly why they called themselves socialists. Their interest wasn't the private individual making money. Their interest, they explained, was in making the community, including the economy, work for everyone, be a social institution, not so much a private one, a social institution that put the people as a whole front and center, not making everything hostage to whether or not some private capitalist found it profitable to hire people, to produce things, etc. And so these socialists began to say, we have a strategy and a vision for the future, something better than capitalism. And it begins in politics, because capitalism brought into being universal suffrage, the idea that everybody should have a vote. And so the socialists quickly understood that the majority of the people in every capitalist society are the employees, and that the owners, the employers, the capitalists are a tiny minority. So, they said, let's use the vote. We're the majority. We can change the society to make it serve all of us without the intermediary role, the middleman, if you like, of the private profiteer, the private enterprise. And they look to the institution of the government, the state. By winning elections, we capture the state. If the people who have the state now, the employer class, put too many obstacles in the way, we'll make a revolution, just like the French Revolution or the American Revolution moved in that way when the peaceful way of doing things simply didn't work. And so the socialists organized political parties to win governmental power, which they have done over the last 200 years in an increasingly common achievement. They also decided to fight the battle in each workplace, in the factory, the office, and the store, by forming labor unions that could contest with the employer right there where production occurred. And the big socialist alliance, of course, was then the Socialist Party trying to take state power, and the labor union trying to be the base of that state power, the majority inside each workplace. The state became the focus. The state, if you captured it, would be the way to move a society away from capitalism and its focus on the minority who have the profit, who control the industry, who become the dominant wealthy because of that, etc. Socialism became a commitment to the state to manage things. And therefore, there are three kinds of socialism in the world today. The Scandinavian or European, where the socialists win a government that regulates industries that remain private. That's what you have in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Western Europe, and so on. The second model of socialism, the Soviet Union, where the government not only regulates, but takes over the private enterprise and runs production, factories, offices, stores, as governmental owned and operated enterprises. And then the third kind of socialism is a hybrid of the first two, a mixture. That's the People's Republic of China, huge private capitalist sector, huge government-owned and operated sector, and a communist party controlling the government that supervises them all. These are alternative kinds of socialism, but they have one thing in common. It's a focus on the state. The state as regulator, the state as controller, the state as owner-operator, or mixtures of them. And that became the great struggle of capitalism and socialism in the 20th century. More government, government intrusion, government control, socialism. Less and less government involvement, capitalism. Private versus state, that's the way the argument was put. That worked to spread socialism globally, but it also produced the decline of socialism in the last 30 to 40 years. Something was wrong, something was missing in socialism that gave them, on the one hand, the great success of growth in the 19th and 20th century, and the stalling of their growth pretty much the second half of the 20th century, getting worse and worse as the years passed. In the second half of today's program, we're going to identify what was wrong, what was missing, and show how a socialism for the 21st century, by repairing the omission, by fixing the problem, can give a whole new impetus to what socialism can and probably will mean in the century just now beginning. Stay with us. We've reached the end of the first half. We'll be right back. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. We were talking in the first half about socialism, its successes in growing in the 19th and for much of the 20th century. It's becoming a global phenomena. We talked about the differences among the types of socialism, but we ended up with my pointing out that socialism has hit some kind of problem time in the last 20, 30, 40 years. The 21st century is not experiencing the further growth of socialism that we saw in the 19th and 20th. Now, part of that is the relentless opposition to socialism that the supporters of capitalism have always waged. Part of socialism's difficulty has been the enormous repressive effort put against it everywhere in the world. It's an amazing success story that it spread, and if you understand against what a kind of oppression and repression it spread, well, the success is more impressive still. And yet, it's in trouble now. And I want to say what I think that is. But before I do, I want to say that every movement that has ever developed in the world had, on the one hand, pressures against it that it had to try to overcome, but that sometimes its own difficulty was not only about the repression against it, but also about its own decisions, some of which had to be acknowledged as either wrongheaded or maybe good ideas, but whose time has passed. I'm going to argue that that's exactly what happened to socialism. Very good idea, built it in the 19th and 20th century, but is now a problem. The very success of socialism exposes its problem. So let's make that argument. Socialists in many parts of the world are now governments. Russia, for a long time under the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China now refers to itself as socialism with Chinese characteristics. The governments of European countries, several of them, are now socialist parties that are in power. Virtually every government in Europe has had socialists who've been presidents or prime minister. Socialism now has a record, not only as it did in the 19th and early 20th century, as a critical movement against capitalism, but socialism now has an identity as a way of running a society. And therein the problem arose. Because when socialists grabbed the state, either through the electoral process or through revolutions, or sometimes mixtures of both, we now know what they did. In Scandinavia and Western Europe, the government became an overall director, a controller, a regulator. Even in the United States, there were examples of that. In the Soviet Union, the government became the actual operator, owner of the enterprise, sort of like the United States government post office, or Amtrak, or the Tennessee Valley Authority. And then there were the mixtures. Here in the United States, 95% private, a very small governmental sector. In the People's Republic of China, kind of 50-50. And in the Soviet Union, 100% the government. But here comes the problem. Wherever the government took over, whatever it did, the regulatory examples of Western Europe, the control examples of the Soviet Union, and even the hybrid examples of China. What has not yet been shown is that the socialism was actually able to overcome the economic and political inequalities that plagued capitalism, that plague it to this day, as we can see when we look at Elon Musk or Jeffrey Bezos, and the vast majority of Americans having trouble feeding themselves, giving their kids an education, and all the rest. Socialism didn't deliver. It didn't deliver the promise of an equal society, a just society, where everybody starts more or less on the same level playing field and can use their talents, their drive, their ambition, to get as far in life as those qualities make possible. And the people in modern society know it. They're no longer willing and able to follow the argument, if only the state is brought in more than we can do. Yeah, didn't work. So I prefer to go in a different direction and say, those socialists who did all that in the 19th and 20th century, who focused on the state, who hoped and dreamed that the state would enable them to make the change of system from capitalism to socialism. They did, and they dreamed productively. But they overlooked something. They omitted something. And that something is what held them down now, what plagues them now, what prevents them from being the beacon to draw the working class together now. It's not a mistake so much as it is a failure to recognize an omission and to repair it, to fill it in, to do what you didn't do before, not because what you did before was wrong, but before what you did before wasn't enough. And you got to do something else. And here is the argument. To change the relationship between private enterprise and the government, to give the government more or less interference, control, intervention, whatever you want to call it, that doesn't change, here we go now, the basic organization of production. The actual lived reality of human relationships inside the factory, inside the office, inside the store. When the socialists took over, they didn't change that very much. When the socialists took over, nothing was more frequent than the joke of the worker. Gee, it isn't all that much different than it used to be. Whatever the change from capitalism to socialism meant, it didn't include a revolution inside the workplace. It made big changes in the relationship of the government to private capitalists, controlling them, regulating them, replacing them, whatever. It was big over there in the macro, in the large picture. But in the daily life of the working class, the vast majority, whether the government regulated industry or not, whether the government was the industry or not, they came to work around 8 or 9 in the morning, and they stayed until 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and they did what they were told by the supervisors and the employers who made all the basic decisions that the mass of people had to live with. Socialists kept their revolution in the community and in the larger society. They never brought it into the core of the production system. They omitted that. What could they have done? Well, the answer is human history. For thousands of years, working people, whether they were villagers or slaves or serfs or proletarian workers, have had dreams of a way of working radically different from what they were subjected to. A way of working that was a community of equals who got together to produce something the larger society needed. They wanted to do that as a community of equals. We have seen efforts to do that in every society, in every religion, as a noble effort to break out of the dichotomy master-slave, or the dichotomy lord-serf, or the dichotomy employer-employee. What socialists could have and should have integrated into the core of what they're about is not just to bring the state and society in to the economic decisions, to not let a small minority of capitalist owners, profit-driven, be the intermediary who decides everything. That's not enough. And that's what the 21st century is teaching socialists. It's not enough. It was a big step. It was an important step. You made huge gains. You established an important law of society being directly involved. But society has to be directly involved inside every factory, office, and store, too. It turns out that socialism faced a question it did not come to terms with. Here's that question. Maybe it's the case. And let's put it as a question. Can you sustain a socialist revolution that puts the state in a powerful position in society as a whole without putting workers in a powerful position inside the workplace? I think history's answer to that question is you cannot. You cannot even sustain the socialism you were successful in establishing, starting with the Russian Revolution and spreading ever since. You weren't able to save it, to preserve it, to sustain it. And maybe, question, maybe was that because you didn't change the reality inside where people work? The factory, the office, the store, and that other place where people work, the household, the family. Maybe the revolutions that changed families when slavery gave way to feudalism, that changed families again from feudalism to capitalism. Maybe the whole concept of family has to be rethought, re-understood, questioned. Socialists have to have the daring to recognize the omission of that level of society when the revolution was discussed. Fix it. Bring the revolution into those areas from which it was excluded. If democracy is the central principle we want to uphold, then we have to democratize the workplace too. Democracy in the workplace is the opposite of the autocratic dictatorship of the CEO in a business, of the owner, of the operator. Either you live in a community and understand the community as necessarily democratic, or you don't. Socialism can reimagine itself, redefine itself, and become even more powerful in the 21st century, in my judgment, if and to the extent that it offers a vision of a new workday life. That's where most adults spend most of their lives, at work. And work can be a democratic community that you enjoy, that you want to go to, where you learn, where you are nurtured in your relationships with other people. Not a place of being a drudge, being a drone, and listening to the orders of employers whose only interest is making money versus building a society. A socialism with that kind of vision, that will be a socialism that builds successfully on what it did in the 19th and 20th century, but also recognizes what it didn't do, what wasn't enough, and what will be necessary to win the support of the mass of working people in the years ahead. Thank you very much for your attention, as always, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.